You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
This episode of the Doug and Trussell Family Hour podcast is brought to you by Squarespace.com. Go to Squarespace.com and use offer code Duncan to get 10% off a beautiful website. Hello, my dear sweet friends. It is I, Duncan Trussell, and you're listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. And if you're like millions and millions of people currently existing on this beautiful planet, floating in space, then you've tried a psychedelic drug before. You've taken LSD, mushrooms, maybe you've smoked some DMT, maybe you've taken MDMA. A lot of people say that's not a psychedelic. I think it is. But you've taken some kind of substance, and somewhere in the heightened state of awareness that you were experiencing, somewhere in the midst of having an explosion of epiphanies, or realizing that there's certain areas of your life that you need to work on, or realizing that you need to maybe call your mom and tell her you're sorry for being such a jackass for the last 15 years, or maybe just in the midst of having a really great picnic with some friends, or maybe even while experiencing some of the most incredible sex that you've ever had in your life, or maybe somewhere in between bites of some food that you've eaten for your entire life but you're tasting for the first time right then, or maybe somewhere as you're gazing down at the shadows of the trees as they move upon whatever body of water you're sitting in front of, and you realize that those shadows almost look like some kind of ancient primordial language, and it occurs to you that language itself could be the shadow of God. Or maybe just as you are enjoying a nice day alone at home in a heightened state of awareness, the terrible thought entered into your consciousness that the experience that you are having has been criminalized by your government. And it probably gave you pause. It sure has given me pause more than a few times as I'm sitting wherever I happen to be sitting, or walking wherever I happen to be walking, feeling a kind of buoyant state of connection to my entire species and a desire to be kind and to listen and to give more and to help more, and the sense of wanting to really make the most of my life. It's occurred to me during those moments that have been brought on by imbibing prohibited substances that this experience is not just an important experience, but a vital experience and my own personal growth. And that the fact that some government has made this experience illegal seems to be an indication of a terrible mistake. And if not a mistake, then something so incredibly sinister that if you think about it too long while under the influence of a psychoactive drug, you might actually feel a shadow creeping into your trip. You might begin to get a little paranoid or start looking around and wondering if there's a police officer nearby who is going to notice that you have a radiant grin on your face and see that as probable cause to look through your stuff. And if he happens to find anything in your bag or your pockets that has been deemed illegal by the government, then he will have the right to throw handcuffs on you, put you in the back of a squad car, and take you to the dungeons. And if you think about it too long, things can get really dark and sinister. And I think a lot of trips have gone from being pretty awesome to being pretty terrible just by that consideration that the incredible experience that these substances provide to us has for illogical or political or nefarious reasons been criminalized. As far as I'm concerned, this is one of the most absurd aspects of the modern society that we currently exist in. But thankfully, things have begun to shift. They're shifting because of the tireless effort of folks like Rick Doblin and the people over at MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. These are the folks doing the heavy lifting, and if you're a psychonaut, if you're somebody who recognizes the insanity of our current drug policy, then I really hope you'll spend some time over at their website at maps.org and see if you can figure out a way to help them out. And I'm really grateful that Rick took the time to be on this podcast. We're going to dive right into it, but first, some very quick business. This episode of the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast is brought to you by those sweet technological gnomes over at squarespace.com. Squarespace.com. If you enter in offer code Duncan, you're going to get 10% off your first purchase. And why wouldn't you want your own website? You know, I just did a quick perusal of available domain names, and I can't believe what great domain names are out there that people haven't scooped up yet. Grannyfeet.com, available. IAteHumanFlesh.com, available. NippleManager.com, available. And can you believe this one's available? PoopBalloon.com is somehow, inexplicably, still available, waiting for you to pick it up, to buy it. Be the owner of PoopBalloon.com. How is that not a mega website? How is PoopBalloon.com not generating millions of dollars? How come all of Silicon Valley has not swarmed that domain name? PoopBalloon. It sounds good, it makes sense, and it could be yours. All you got to do is go to Squarespace.com and sign up for a year. You will get a free domain name. You can own PoopBalloon.com. You can make it a blog. You can make it your podcast. You could actually have images of balloons filled with poop. You could do whatever you want. Make it an art experiment. You could actually make it a super intellectual, academic, philosophical blog where people go and they don't understand how such brilliance is under the website Poop Balloon. It's just there for you to do. They've got 24/7 support, live chat and email. It's only $8 a month. They've got responsive design. That means that your website is going to look good on any device. Each website comes with a free online store. Let me tell you, I think I'd be tempted to buy a Poop Balloon t-shirt. I would probably wear a t-shirt that said poopballoon.com. You could sell shirts at Poop Balloon. I might buy Poop Balloon before I upload this podcast just because I want to own that domain name. Grannyfeet.com. Look, I don't want to tell you, but that's a gold mine. There, that's a gold mine. You know why, I know why. And IAteHumanFlesh.com. That could be a blog dedicated to stories of people who've eaten human flesh. It could be recipes for human flesh, or it could be warnings about what happens if you eat human flesh. This is all there for you. It's out there. All you got to do is grab it. These sweet, golden, electronic fruits are hanging on the World Wide Web tree, just waiting for you to pluck them and go to Squarespace. You could have Poop Balloon up and running so fast just by going to squarespace.com, where you can build it beautiful. You can also start a trial with no credit card required. You can start building your website today, just to make sure you know how to do it. But why not? Has there ever been a better way to prank people? Has there ever been a better way to create benign chaos in the world? No, I think not. Work your chaos magic. Throw your sigil up on your new Squarespace website. But go there and put in offer code Duncan. You get 10% off. And please support them because they support this podcast. I've got a tour coming up, my dear, darling friends, and I hope that you will come. I also have some guests that I can't say all the guests yet, and I think some of the guests in New York, I'm thinking about keeping a surprise, but We've got a lot of wonderful shows coming up. I'm going to be at the Improv on the 18th. That's the Hollywood Improv on the 18th of this month with Daniele Bellelli is my guest, and I may have another guest. I'm still working on that, but for sure, Mr. Bellelli, the drunken Taoist himself, will be there. I'm going to be in Arlington on April 22nd with Abby Martin. I highly recommend going back and listening to the podcast I did with her. She's an amazing journalist, and I'm really looking forward to that conversation. I'm going to be in Cambridge, Massachusetts with Johnny Pemberton, and I'm going to be in Philadelphia with Johnny Pemberton, and I'm going to be in Brooklyn with Emil Amos for the 25th and 26th. And also, it looks like I'm going to be there with Alex and Allison Gray on the 25th and 26th as guests. But unfortunately, that show is sold out. But if God is with me, then there's a very exciting announcement that I will have about Brooklyn, but I can't make it now. I can only tease you about it. So anyway, grab the tickets. They're located at DuncanTrussell.com. We also have got a shop with some cool t-shirts, Ron Rigi Enneagram t-shirts, some posters, and some mugs. I hope you'll go there and pick up some merchandise. And finally, thank you to all of you who have been using our Amazon portal. For those of you who don't know what that is, if you go to DuncanTrussell.com on any of the podcast episodes, there is a portal. And if you click through that, you'll go to Amazon.com, and anything that you buy, they give us a very small percentage, and it's a great way for you to support this podcast. It doesn't cost you anything at all, and Amazon.com is a wonderful thing because it keeps you from having to get in your car and drive to some chain store and risk being decapitated, mugged, sneezed on by a vampire, attacked by wild dogs. You could be dragged into the basement of the place by a disgruntled manager and fisted for weeks and weeks and weeks. So many awful things can happen to you. I don't know if you heard about that poor kid at that chain store in New Jersey who had his armpits chopped out and replaced with onions. That kid is ruined for the rest of his life, and all he had to do was go through our portal located at Amazon.com. Why would you risk decapitation, emasculation? Why would you risk having your face sawed off by some jittering, angry manager in the last leg of his life, just ready to die? And before he goes out, he's gonna saw off some faces and maybe even set some feet on fire. Don't do it. Are you going to risk your life just so you can buy some deodorant? Why would you do that when you can go through our portal, go to Amazon, and a sweet, dainty, perfumed UPS man will come to your door and give you a box with some deodorant in it. And if you're lucky, he might come inside and make sweet love to you, dripping his pheromones all over your chest and back as he thrusts deep into the inner sanctum of your soul. Go through our portal, won't you? It's located in the comments section of every episode of this podcast. Okay, great. That's it. We're going to get on with this show. As you know, today's guest is Rick Doblin. You can find out everything you need to know about Rick and the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies by going to maps.org. I hope you will visit them. And if you're feeling particularly generous, I hope you will throw them some green energy because they deserve it. They're on the front lines, and if anything is going to change this ridiculous war on drugs, if anything is going to shift these archaic, tyrannical, and stupid drug policies that we currently have, it's going to be because of the folks at MAPS and because of Rick Doblin and because of their colleagues wherever they may be. Now, everybody, please welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast, Rick Doblin.
It's the Duncan Trussell Family Hour.
Rick Doblin, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It is a real honor to get to talk with you today.
Oh, thank you, Duncan. I'm so glad to be speaking with you as well and all the people listening to your podcast.
You are in the world of psychedelics, you are a hero. And you're and forgive me for, I don't mean to dehumanize yeah. you by putting you on too high a platform here, but you are something of a saint. You have sacrificed your spinal fluid in the pursuit of getting MDMA as a prescription therapy. So thank you on behalf of every person who stands to benefit for that and all of us who've experienced MDMA and have immediately realized that this could do a lot of good for the world.
Well, thank you. And not just one spinal tap, but two.
Oof.
But I figured that the way I actually did it is two parts. One is I was sort of daring George Riccardi to show that he could find damage in myself and friends who were using MDMA. But I started realizing that there was a war on drugs, and you know, in war, people are willing to make certain kind of sacrifices, and I was fighting on the side of freedom and drugs. But the real way that I was able to do it was to imagine that I was sort of giving birth to my spinal fluid.
Mm.
And that if women can go through the pain of childbirth, I felt like it's a relatively small thing to have a needle go into my spinal column. And so that's actually how I did it. I imagined myself sort of giving birth to the spinal fluid, and it, you know, it hurt, but it didn't hurt that much.
For those folks out there who aren't aware of MAPS, can you talk about the mission of MAPS?
Sure. MAPS is Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. It's a nonprofit organization that I started in 1986 after we had won an initial lawsuit against the DEA, which they started trying in 1984 to criminalize MDMA. They weren't aware of the therapeutic use of MDMA, but they had become aware of the recreational use of ecstasy.
Right.
And so when they moved against ecstasy, we took them by surprise, and I went to D.C. and filed a lawsuit trying to preserve the therapeutic use of MDMA. And we had a long court case before a DEA administrative law judge and won the case. It was fantastic. And the law judge had recommended to the head of the DEA that MDMA be illegal for non-medical use, but it be Schedule 3, meaning it could still be used therapeutically. And the head of the DEA rejected that recommendation. And then we sued in the appeals court and won, and the DEA came up with a new rationale for keeping it illegal. And then we sued again, and then we won. And then on the third time, DEA finally wised up and figured out how to keep it illegal. And so I started MAPS in 86, recognizing that, you know, this was the Reagan era, the escalation of the drug war, that the only way to bring it back was through the FDA, mm. and that the pharmaceutical industry, the government, the big foundations, none of them were going to support this kind of controversial research. And so I felt like it needed to be nonprofit oriented and come from funding from individuals. And so that's basically what I've been doing since 86, although it wasn't until 1999 that the first drug was ever approved by FDA through a nonprofit organization. Hmm. And that drug turned out to be the abortion pill, RU-46.
Wow.
And it was funded by the Rockefellers, the Pritzkers, and the Buffetts. Warren Buffett donated over $5 million to it.
Wow.
And so I've sort of thought at that time, and that was when I was working on my PhD at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, on the regulation of the medical use of psychedelics and marijuana. And I always thought that that was really my dream team. If I could get the Rockefellers, the Pritzkers, and the Buffetts together again to fund MDMA research. And so far, we've gotten support from Richard Rockefeller and some of his family members, and then
wow.
also from Nick and Susan Pritzker. And I'm just hoping on the Buffetts.
That is incredible, because something that I've learned from researching you a little bit is that the people who you might expect to be completely against this kind of research really seem to support it or be interested in it. I would never think that the Rockefellers would have any interest in psychedelic research, or that some of the people in the upper echelons of government would be so open to it. Is what's happened? What's this change?
Well, I think that it's all too easy to sort of stereotype people. And so when we think about the Rockefellers, you know, John D. Rockefeller, the richest person in the world, kind of a vulture capitalist in some ways.
Yes.
But, you know, down the generations, people's attitudes change. And Richard Rockefeller, who tragically died in a plane crash, became about, you know, about 9 months ago, a little bit more, he became the ideal partner for me. We became close friends and we're working together. And Richard was somebody who was very remarkable. You know, he felt that even though he had been given so much freedom and resources and reputation from his family, that he needed something that was his own to, you know, have a sense of pride. And he decided that he would become a doctor. And he actually was a family physician for a long time. And he became the chairman of the board of advisors of Doctors Without Borders.
Wow.
And as part of that work, he became aware of whole populations that were traumatized, that were refugees, particularly in Kosovo and Serbia. And he started wondering, how do you help whole populations that are traumatized? We don't have the resources to do psychotherapy with every individual.
Right.
Psychotherapy doesn't always help a lot of people. And he started looking into MDMA as a possible way to deal with multi-generational trauma. And he had the connections, the inspiration, and excuse me. He also, you know, had the sense of idealism. The Rockefellers, a lot of the Rockefellers are actually quite liberal. And, you know, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund just announced that they were divesting all of their investments from oil.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. So I think what really motivated Richard was this sense that down the generations, when you have trauma, like in Israel and Palestine,
yes,
and all sorts of other locations, that this kind of trauma is really passed down, and just conflicts can go on for hundreds of years, thousands of years. They seem insoluble. And there has to be some way to break this cycle of multi-generational trauma. So once Richard started looking into MDMA as potential therapy, and we started talking, and he knew people that had profound beneficial experiences with MDMA for grieving, for PTSD, yes, for military service. He wanted to know what was the most important way that he could be helpful to us and that we could work together. And I said that we had 25 years of struggle with the Department of Defense and the Veterans Administration trying to interest them in MDMA for post-traumatic stress disorder in soldiers and veterans. And we'd been working with lots of doctors and therapists who were close to the people that were suffering, that were committing suicide, that were desperate. But the political level always blocked it. And I said, I need help with the Department of Defense and the VA. And it turned out that Richard's cousin was Senator Jay Rockefeller from West Virginia, who was on the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee.
Wow.
So we started a long project that took many, many years. And, you know, I started realizing that from Richard's point of view, the fact that it was so hard was actually a good thing, because he had so much capacity and he wanted to really do hard things. And so we ended up exchanging, you know, thousands of emails, getting to be close friends. And for me, you know, I talked a little bit about, you know, 1984 with DEA cracking down on MDMA and 1986 when I started MAPS. But really for me, it started in 1972 when I was a Vietnam War draft resistor and I was doing a lot of LSD, but having difficult time integrating it. You know,
yes,
somewhat like your comedy routine. I had some very difficult LSD experiences, but I had this glimmer that there was something healing about it. And I went to the guidance counselor at New College of Sarasota, Florida, and said, what can I do? And this guidance counselor actually gave me a copy of a book by Dr. Stanislav Grof, Realms of the Human Unconscious.
Wow.
And Stan was the leading LSD researcher and theoretician, and I was just so lucky that this – but when I read that, it all came together for me, this idea of science looking at spirituality and values and, you know, unit of mystical experiences as well as psychotherapy encased in a healing process but subject to critical testing through does it actually help people to get better. So I felt like at that time that I would devote myself to bringing back psychedelics back to the mainstream and bringing back psychedelic research. And because of the fact that I was a draft resistor and I anticipated going to jail, I felt like I couldn't have a normal career. And so for me now, after all of these years, when Richard comes along and I said, okay, let's try to make peace with the military in a way when it comes to psychedelics.
Yes.
He took on that challenge. And so I've actually had this remarkable experience of walking into the Pentagon with Richard Rockefeller and Dr. Michael Mithofer, who is our lead psychiatrist for our work with MDMA. And, you know, Michael had had a ponytail for about 30 years that he cut off for the meeting at the Pentagon.
Oh, wow.
And it was incredible because I remember Abby Hoffman and the Yippies, you know, they – part of the protests against the Vietnam War, they surrounded the Pentagon and they talked, okay, we're going to levitate the Pentagon.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, it didn't work. And so here we are all these years later walking into the door talking about, you know, bringing psychedelics to the military.
That is so incredible. And it's so.
Yeah. And Jay Rockefeller was willing to do it. So we've had meetings in the Pentagon with the senior people at the Department of Defense. Staff from the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs, and things have turned around. And I think it's because of the dire need of all these vets coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and also the ones from Vietnam. But somehow that, you know, the culture was too resistant during that several decades after the Vietnam War. But it's only more now with the maturation of the culture, the disillusionment with prohibition and mass incarceration, the racist nature of the drug war, and people are, and also the rise of medical marijuana and people's more comfort with marijuana legalization, that we're finding a greater willingness among all aspects of the culture to really look at psychedelics. And I think there's also this other big aspect of how we're not so much using the same rhetoric of we've done psychedelics, we're enlightened, and we're smarter than everybody else, and one dose, miracle cure. And, you know, Timothy Leary was great as an advocate for individual freedom and individual liberty against the system. But he was also portraying psychedelics as somehow or other inherently countercultural, that if you took these drugs, you were always going to be against systems and always an enemy of the state. And if you look historically through thousands of years, most cultures have had an honored place for peoples who alter their consciousness.
And that's right.
For even from our own culture, the Greeks, when we look back at the history of Western thought, the largest, the longest running mystery ceremony ever was the Eleusinian Mysteries that ran for almost 2,000 years and ended around 396, squashed by the church.
Yeah.
Because they were more of a direct access to spirituality rather than mediated through a power system.
Right.
But Albert Hoffman and Gordon Wasson and others, Carl Ruck, experts, looked at the Eleusinian Mysteries and found that there was a drink that they consumed called Kikion, and it had rye and barley. And when we look more even closely at it, when you have sort of moisture and kind of a fungus, an ergot grows on rye and barley, and it contains drugs that are very much like LSD.
Right.
So it's from our own tradition, and other traditions like the Native American church use of peyote and the use of mushrooms that go back thousands of years and ayahuasca that goes back a long time, that we're a cultural aberration. And there's reasons for that even, too, that our mind, our intellect was squashed by the church, by religion, by fundamentalism. And we see that with Copernicus and Galileo. And there was kind of a truce for 400 or 500 years of religion staying out of science and science staying out of religion. But Now that's even coming together. So there's tremendous scientific research at Johns Hopkins, at the University of Zurich, elsewhere, where people are looking at lifelong meditators, spiritual leaders, and giving them psychedelics and looking how that impacts them. So we see, I think, that in our current time, with globalization, with religions bumping up against each other, that what we really need, I think, to survive is this sense of what we have in common rather than what we have that's different.
Right.
And under the influence of psychedelics, people can have these unitive mystical experiences that connect us up with, you know, billions of years of history and thousands of years of human evolution. And, you know, and people can understand how intimately connected we are with nature, not separate from it, and how really we're much more similar to even the most different cultural human than we are different.
Rick, are you?
And if we can feel that, and for me, this was confirmed in 1984 when I got in touch with a fellow named Robert Mueller, who was the Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations. And he'd written this book called New Genesis, Shaping a Global Spirituality. And his basic idea was that we have United Nations to mediate disputes between cultures. And if you look more carefully, a lot of those disputes are religious disputes. And we need to get the mystics together to build this sense of alliance and for people to have a global spirituality, which doesn't mean one world religion. It just means that we realize that there's, you know, a whole rainbow of colors, and they're all part of the spectrum, and they're all ways to try to point to something deeper. And we find that, you know, the religions that are more mystically based are more tolerant. And, you know, Stan Grof wanted to go to Israel. I just came back from around 3 weeks in Israel with Stan, where he had talks in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and Sfat, sort of the mystical center of Israel.
Yes.
And his idea is to eventually to have a conference that would focus on the common mystical roots of the Abrahamic traditions, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, as a way to talk about fundamentalism being replaced by mysticism, and that mysticism is an antidote to fundamentalism.
Our mysticism is almost the fermentation of fundamentalism. It's the, after some certain amount of time, you get a roomie or you get these mystics who are taking the fundamental hardcore stuff and converting it into something that's more passionate and juicy and beautiful.
Yes, exactly. And so I think that's really the larger vision. So when we talk about MAPS as a nonprofit pharmaceutical company, that's really what we are. That's our strategic approach. That's what I've been trained in through the degree at the Kennedy School and also through my training with Stan Grof. But really, it's about integrating psychedelics and even more beyond that, not just psychedelics, but non-ordinary states of consciousness into our culture, where I think people can have a deeper sense of meaning, a deeper sense of purpose, more tolerance, antidote to prejudice of all sorts. And so I think, given all the crises that we face as a nation, as a culture, as a world, as a planetary species, I think really that psychedelics can play a major role in grounding people into something deeper and helping us really deal with the ways that we're all bumping up against people who are different than ourselves, and see that as a source of pleasure and joy and curiosity rather than as a source of fear and isolationism.
Right. Yeah, that is it's almost like some kind of drought that many cultures are going through, which is a complete lack of access to psychoactive substances that seem to have possibly spawned these religions, spawned the myths, or at least been co-pilots in spawning these ideas. And it feels like a lot of the problems that you're talking about, many of us think that those problems are directly related to removing from the bloodstream of a species chemicals that seem to have been part of the growth of that species, of the subjective growth, or the birth of maybe even the birth of language, not to get too Terrence McKenna level hippie on you, but
well, I think he was onto something, and I think you're right, and I think, though, you know, to sort of talk in a balanced way, though, you know, the irrational is really scary. The beyond rationality. So when we look at people, leaders like Hitler or leaders like Pol Pot or, you know, others that are able to commit massive genocide, you know, they play on people's unconscious needs and fears. And so there is some wisdom in a sense of trying to, you know, focus on rationality. But it really, it was just a veneer. It's not enough. We have to refine the unconscious. We have to refine the irrational rather than try to turn our backs on it and become. So if we look at what we've done with our modern culture, I mean, we have miraculous technology that has been accomplished. I mean, just the same way that I'm talking to you, that you can do this podcast, yes, that people can listen from all over the world. It's just miraculous, and it's the product of our rational mind, but it's not enough. We cannot build a world that turns its back on the irrational and turns its back on the spiritual and just tries to persuade people on the basis of logical arguments. We need to delve deep into the irrational and help refine it. And so that's where one hopes that as time goes by, as generations go down the road here, that we'll be able to use these psychedelic tools to bring the irrational up in safe enough supportive contexts so that enough people can become more balanced, more grounded, and they can be helpful as the species tries to move forward and not destroy ourselves.
I'm really interested in the safe and supportive setting that you're talking about, which seems to be your description of what psychedelic therapy would look like. Can you talk a little bit about what a typical session, a therapeutic session with MDMA would look like?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd be glad to. I think that's a really good thing to focus on as well. Because, again, what we're talking about is MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. It's not the, like the traditional pharmaceutical companies say, here, take this pill, it's going to make you better. What we're saying is these drugs, the psychedelics, are used in contexts, and those contexts are crucial, either therapeutic context, right, or religious context for ayahuasca or peyote or
fun.
It's just really the context makes more of a difference than the drug itself.
Right.
And so a traditional MDMA session, the first thing is that we are talking about a several-month period of psychotherapy with weekly non-drug psychotherapy for several weeks of hour and a half sessions for the therapist and the patient to build a therapeutic alliance, get comfortable with each other.
Yes.
And then once a month, basically every 3 to 5 weeks, for three times, there's a day-long MDMA session or a day-long LSD or psilocybin session. And then the subjects are asked to spend the night in the treatment center. That's very important for our approach. And then there's integrative psychotherapy the next day. Then once they go home, we contact them on the phone every day for a week for 10 minutes, 15 minutes a day just to see how they're doing. Then we repeat the weekly non-drug psychotherapy for 3 to 5 weeks and then repeat that several times. So,
wow.
The question is, though, what happens during the actual MDMA session?
Yes.
Now, the first part of what we're doing is that we talk about a two-person therapy team, and it's a male-female team. Now, some people have said, you know, maybe you can have, you know, a straight guy and a gay guy, or, you know, a straight woman and a gay woman, or, you know. And of course, that could work, and of course, a lot of therapy is fine with just one person. But in our current approach, we're trying to maximize outcomes. We're not trying to minimize costs.
Okay.
And that's why, of course, we're constantly asking people for donations.
Yes.
But we feel that a male-female therapy team, particularly a two-person team, and ideally male-female, works really, really well. Because in psychedelic states with MDMA or LSD or psilocybin, people often regress or bring up things that are from their childhood.
Right.
Or even from their birth process, or even from, you know, symbols like, you know, past life experiences.
Or epigenetics, who knows?
Spiritual experiences. So we use a male-female team because it's kind of, it's you know, we're trying to sort of show a successful male-female partnership. And right. also it's exhausting for an 8-hour session. Somebody has to go to the bathroom. Somebody gets something to eat. We always want somebody in the room. And also we want two eyes, two intuitions kind of listening to what the person is going through.
What does the room look like? Can you describe the room? What is the setting? Because right now my brain is producing a clinical laboratory room, sterile and flat. What does the room actually look like?
Well, there's art, there's flowers, there's a bed. So the main thing is there's a bed.
Yeah.
Couch where people can recline. They have eye shades and headphones. We have music the whole time, or not the whole time. Sometimes people turn off the music and are just talking.
Cool.
There's an adjacent bathroom, so people can privately, go to the bathroom.
Cool.
And it's not a long walk. There can be windows, skylights, but again, some of this takes place in hospital settings where we have to do a lot of work to kind of make it a comfortable room.
Right.
But we've been able to negotiate with FDA, DEA, institutional review boards, where we've been able to get permission to do research outside of clinical hospital settings in office settings that are more like homes.
Right.
And that these are very comfortable situations. And the setting matters a lot. So there'll be fresh flowers. There'll also be fruit juices. We tend to prefer fruit juices, things with electrolytes rather than just water. People have heard about how MDMA, you could overheat and you have to drink water.
Yes.
But some people have died from drinking too much water.
Right.
So, things with electrolytes. And then there's chairs where the two therapists are either on the same side of the bed or a different side. We also suggest that for MDMA, about half the time is spent in dialogue with the therapist, but another half the time is spent with the people's eyes closed going inward and listening to their own selves, not having to report back. The next day is kind of for review of what happened and integrating it, but people are considered to be their own healers. So in the sense, we don't say that the therapists are the guides. We never use the word guides, really.
Right.
The guide is the person's own inner unconscious.
Cool.
And the same way, the metaphor I think works pretty well, is that if you have a scratch on your hand, your body knows how to heal itself. We don't know how to do it, but somehow or other, there's this cellular knowledge built into our body to heal itself. And what we need to do is clean out the wound. We need to protect it from dirt, but the body heals itself.
Right.
And there's something similar going on with the psyche. And this is now something that we believe, something that we feel has been experimentally validated from even the early work with the LSD and psychedelics in the 50s and 60s and our current work over the last decades and currently. So the idea is that there's a self-healing mechanism of the unconscious, and that what comes to the surface during this session is something that is really guided by the person's unconscious. And there's no one pathway or one sequence. So some people under the influence of MDMA will start talking about their trauma and what happened and how it's bothering them. Some people will go back to, pleasant experiences in their lives and sort of reconnect with love and support. And then they go into the painful trauma.
Right.
There's no one way to do it. And so we follow the lead of the patient or the subject. And we support them, and we have the feeling that if there's anything that starts to come up, that they can best look at it and try to integrate it rather than suppress it. And we offer support for them to do it. But we also recognize that sometimes things come up, and it takes a while. Maybe they're too painful. People put them away, and then 2 hours later it comes back again when they're more prepared for it. So we don't press. We have an agreement that if during this 8 hours of session, if people don't talk about the trauma, we'll bring it up. But we've never had to do that. People will always, at some point, start talking about their trauma because they know that's what they're there for. That's what has been bothering them.
And this trauma is generally you're talking about PTSD. These are veterans who've had experiences at war, like awful experiences, and that's the trauma. Is that?
Yes. Yes. Although we just got permission to start a new study with MDMA for people who have life-threatening illnesses and who are scared of dying.
Right.
And we also have a study that is with autistic adults with social anxiety.
Yeah, it's so incredible to listen to how in-depth and how hard, for lack of a better word, how stringent this experience is when compared to the way so many of us recreationally take MDMA, which is or any psychedelic for that matter. You'll take the psychedelic. If you plan it out right, maybe you'll go on a camping trip or you'll go somewhere away from society with your friends, and a lot of it's just laughing and talking. You might go dancing, but this idea of turning inward, putting blindfolds on, laying down, and like doing the work on yourself, it really is different, I think, than the way a lot of people perceive how to take a psychedelic.
Yeah, I think so. And even in terms of the music, so what we try to do is avoid music with lyrics. So we don't want to sort of guide people into certain kinds of thinking or certain kinds of imagery. We want it as much as possible to emerge from themselves. So we'll have different kinds of music throughout the 8 hours or so, but it tends to be without lyrics. Sometimes there's voices, but without words. So we try to encourage sort of pure emotional release. And it's even more different with LSD or psilocybin, where probably it's 80% inner focused and 20% dialogue. Oh. And we also then try to say to people that they really need to think about it as a 2-day experience, not even a 1-day experience, and that the second day is for rest, for reflection. That's why we want people to spend the night in the treatment center also, quietly reflecting on it. We do let people's significant others spend the night with them sometimes, unless, you know, they're sources of the conflict or the problem.
Right.
But I think when people can think about it as 2 days, the second day is really for rest and reflection and integration. So we don't give people supplements with MDMA. We don't give them 5-HTP or various things. We just say the key is to rest and integrate. And then that process continues in their dreams in other ways for weeks at a time. And that's how we set the time for the second session, is have they done a pretty complete job of integrating what happened in the first session? And that's how we set the third session. Have they done a pretty good job of integrating the second session? And so what we're saying to people is that this is not about distracting yourself,
right?
Really, with pretty pictures. And that also has to do with the dose. So we use pretty strong doses of MDMA or LSD when we work with people. And we try to say, look, you don't have to have any responsibilities about your physical bodily survival. You don't have to navigate from here to there. You don't have to walk. You don't have to drive. You don't have to get the door. You don't have to get the phone. All of this is for you to focus inward. And, you know, I don't know how many people who are listening who've ever done gone into a flotation tank.
I've done it, and it's incredible. And I think a lot of people listening probably have, or I think some of them have for sure.
Yeah. So it's kind of like that. We want to take away as much of the outside distractions, but we do give supportive music. Sometimes we'll hold people's hand a bit. We'll touch their shoulder. You know, we're there with them. And for the therapist, it's kind of like a meditation session where you're there, you're watching. A lot of it is watching nonverbal cues in their breathing and their body language and their musculature. How are they handling it? Are they, and the key aspect is, are they opening it up and letting it flow through them, or are they resisting? And, you know, as we know, like with a light bulb, you know, what causes the light is the resistance. The electricity hits some resistance and then it heats up. And so we've found that with psychedelics, the less resistance there is, the more flow there is, the more the less drama there is, in a way, and the more healing. And so we try to encourage people to open up, let it go. We videotape and audiotape all the sessions. And wow. We give those tapes to people afterwards if they want to look at them. And it's another way to say to people, you don't have to grab onto something. If you have an insight, you know, you can look at the videotape and bring it back. We'll talk to you about it the next day if you say certain things. We're writing down notes. But that you don't have to grab and hold on to it. Just flow with it. And the longer in my own experiences I've had, too, I find that when I'm resisting, they last longer. And when I'm opening to the energy just flowing to me, they tend to last shorter and I'm more grounded.
What techniques do you What techniques do you give people to let go? How do you this problem you're describing is feels like it's a universal problem.
Yeah.
Are there any techniques you give people who come into contact with some dark realization or go into the dark place? How do you get them to let go in the room?
Well, that's a fantastic question, and that is the key of the therapeutic process. And one way to help them is to say that, you know, looking away, that these are things that are influencing you, and they have more power over you the more unconscious they are.
Hmm.
So that as things are coming to the surface and to consciousness, even though it's painful and difficult, it's like they're there. They're not, if you don't look, it's not like they go away.
Right.
And so by opening up to them, you can make some progress. So the first part, again, is the trust that you create between the therapist and the subject. Also, the therapists have done their own psychedelic work.
Right.
So it's kind of a quiet sense of communication that, you know, if the therapists have never done psychedelics and the patient reaches a frightening spot, you kind of have to know from your own experience that when you let things in that you've been suppressing, that even though it could disrupt your life and cause you to make major changes, that you're better off letting it in and trying to integrate it than not. So we offer support. The idea of the second day with nothing to do is also really important, because a lot of times when people are tripping recreationally,
yeah,
they don't budget that much amount of time. And so when you're starting to take your psyche apart, when your ego is dissolving, if somewhere in the back of your mind you're thinking, oh shit, you know, tomorrow I got to drive to work.
Yes.
You're going to hold yourself back. So we give them the time to really take themselves, to let themselves come apart. We offer support for the integration process. And again, here's where it's really difficult, different than recreational use, because in recreational use, people are looking for an experience while they're under the drug that's valuable to them.
Yes.
And that's appropriate and that's okay. But what we're doing in therapy is looking at not just primarily what you have, but what you bring back to your daily non-drug life.
Right.
And how you can make that different over time. So when people are resisting, one of the things that we'll do is just ourselves, we're not going to run away from it. And we encourage people to take a look, to open up and say that at the same time, we try to say we're not making any decisions during this experience.
Oh, wow. Right. Of course.
It's really important that,
yes.
That, you know, this is exploratory. You know, it's very important for you to explore, but don't feel like any decisions are going to be made here. And in fact, once you've integrated in the next days and weeks, even be careful about making major changes. So that gives people, it's like a brainstorming session.
Right.
Where to get people comfortable brainstorming, you say, don't criticize the ideas, just come up with all these ideas and, you know, leave your critical mind, use your imaginative mind and we'll look at it. So I think that's another big part, is people are freed from making decisions. And if people say, you know, I've just decided I need to get divorced or I need to quit my job.
Yes.
You know, the thing is like, hey, we're saying not so fast.
Right.
You know, just, you know, don't box yourself in. You're just exploring right now.
So phones are gone for these 2 days. Are they gone? Is there no access to the internet or texting or anything?
Well, during the first day, yes. Yes, we take people's phones. There's no – now, you know, we try to keep them there overnight. The next day, you know, they can talk to people, they can be grounded, but we try to have a inner focused life time, which is, you know, increasingly rare in our technological culture.
Right.
You know, my daughter just the other day forgot her phone at home for a brief period of time, and she was like panicked.
It's a nightmare. Oh, God, that feeling of not having access to all information on the planet at every second is terrible. But I want to talk to you a little bit about technology and if MAPS or if anybody out there doing this kind of research has considered the merging of this kind of therapy with virtual reality.
Well, it's very interesting you mentioned that. So in 2009, there was a conference in Israel on treating PTSD. And one of the speakers there was someone who had been funded by the military to develop virtual reality devices for combat soldiers who had PTSD from, you know, being in combat. And there was a woman who has developed one of the leading therapies for post-traumatic stress disorder called prolonged exposure. And she was I think making a little bit of a confusion between MDMA and LSD and the classic psychedelics. MDMA is more gentle. It doesn't affect your perceptions in the same way. You can negotiate with it, whereas with LSD or psilocybin, you really have to just surrender to it. And so she was not that sympathetic to the idea of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD and even a little bit frightened about it. And so she said, you know, I don't really think you even need MDMA. Why don't you go consider virtual reality and go talk to these people that are doing the virtual reality research?
Oh, man.
So I said, all right, that's interesting. So I went to talk to the fellow from who's doing the virtual reality stuff, and he laughed and laughed, and he said, you know, if you have MDMA, you don't need virtual reality. Because what's actually going on is that virtual reality is trying to bring back similar feelings and experiences to the trauma, but in a place where you feel safe.
Right.
But it's never exactly your experience. Your experience is stored in your own memory, in your own unconscious. And so if you can feel safe in a therapeutic setting, your own unconscious will bring out the experiences that were exactly the tailored to what happened to you.
Right. Okay, right.
So yeah, I there can be a role. Now, you know, one of the other things that Stan Grof has done, which is so admirable, is that in the early 70s, when psychedelic research was squashed all over the world, most people who were involved went into looking at the integration process, looking at non-drug approaches, and most of them turned their backs on psychedelics. And there was a classic example of Ram Dass, you know, being attributed to saying, hey, when you've got the message, hang up the phone.
I thought that was Alan Watts, but I guess those quotes get dispersed among all the luminaries. Who knows? But okay, yes.
That's a good point. So yeah, that's if, you know, probably we can check that out on the internet in minutes and figure out who really said it first. But, you know, but the idea is for me that first off, that the messages keep coming through the rest of your life and different messages at different stages of your life. But what Stan did is he developed a way through hyperventilation, which he called holotropic breathwork, yes, moving towards wholeness, that can also bring up things similar to psychedelics. So your question about how do we help people let go? So there's ways where we work with holotropic breathwork where people can stop the breathing, stop the process more easily than once they've taken drugs. That helps people feel a little bit more comfortable with, so you sort of practice a little bit with holotropic breath work. Then with the psychedelics, the idea is that it just helps to, it doesn't really go away. You know, virtual reality can be helpful in certain ways because you can always shut off the program and, you know, but what we're looking at is more and more this understanding of theories of memory, and in particular what's now called memory reconsolidation. And so and this will also explain to people too. So it used to be thought that when you have a memory, it's like you have a book on the shelf and you go read the book and then you put the book back on the shelf.
Right.
Well, what we understand now is that the way memory works is when you pull the book off the shelf, you actually have to reprint the book. You have to recreate the book, and you reconsolidate the memory. You recreate the memory, and then you put it back on the shelf.
That's nuts.
Yeah, and that explains how memories change over time. But that's the key to therapy in the sense, because when you have a traumatic memory, you were raped, you were almost killed in a war, you were in a car crash, natural disaster, something happens, you're focusing on survival, and the memory is encoded with the fear.
Right.
So MDMA reduces activity in the amygdala, the fear processing part of the brain, and you feel safe in this supportive setting, and you trust the therapist. We've made sure you've had a lot of meetings in the room and also with the therapist before you do the MDMA, so you've developed this therapeutic alliance. And so then when you bring back this memory, when you're feeling safe, when you reconsolidate the memory, it doesn't have the tags of fear that it did before.
That is amazing. What you're saying is that MDMA-assisted psychotherapy is doing for memories what those volunteers do for birds after an oil spill. It's sort of scrubbing the fear off of the memories and then putting it back, and now it doesn't have the same high-powered emotional tone connected to it.
Yes, and more importantly even, is that under the influence of MDMA, we've seen veterans, we've seen firefighters that were caught in fires, that their memory is actually enhanced, that there's parts of the trauma that was so difficult for them that they have basically blotted it out of their memory. And under the influence of MDMA, the full memories come back. And so the important thing is that people learn from their trauma. We don't want to obliterate the memory. We don't want to make it so you don't recall, because there's important lessons in trauma.
Yes.
And in fact, one of the measures that we use in our study, now it's not the measure that the FDA will say, yes, you can make this into a medicine, but it's called the post-traumatic growth inventory.
Okay.
And what is the case is that people who've almost died in a car crash or, trauma causes you to reevaluate the meaning of your life, the purpose of your life, your relationships, your job. And that sometimes when you have a trauma and you can survive it, you can actually grow from it. And we hear people who have cancer say, in some ways that was one of the best things that happened to me, because now I survived, but I really understand the precious nature of life, and I'm not wasting my life on a job that I don't care about.
Yep.
So we use this post-traumatic growth inventory as a way to evaluate the positive aspects of how people can grow from trauma, because life inherently has trauma. Life inherently has death. Death is, woven into life inextricably, and we will lose people we love, and we will have accidents, people will die, and all sorts of sad, tragic things will happen, and there is no life without trauma. And we need to grow from the trauma, not run from it. And that's one of the ways where MDMA can be very helpful to people to grow from trauma. And so people have talked about the cannabinoids and how the cannabinoids can be helpful in PTSD, in part because if you administer cannabinoids right at the trauma, sometimes people won't remember the trauma. And that makes me really nervous, because we want people to realize that there are lessons in trauma. If you're in a war, we want people to realize how horrible war is. If you trusted somebody and you were date raped, we want you to realize that you have to be more discerning. We don't want people to forget the traumas. If people are in a car crash and they were texting or something while they were doing it, we don't want people to forget that.
This isn't some brave new world. We're just going to numb you down or take away this stuff. It's more like facing your demons. What you're talking about, it obviously applies not just to people who've had these severe traumas, but every single person living today has had some kind of heartbreak or loss or pain. Will it get to the point where MDMA is prescribed not just for these extreme cases, but what about just the basic crap all of us have to go through in this dimension?
Well, I think that's true. And I think you point to something really important, which is that what we're talking about while we're talking about research into the medical use of MDMA, there's a lot of people who are not clinically diagnosed with a psychiatric illness, but who can make enormous benefits, both in personal growth and spirituality. And so what you're pointing to is that we need to have a post-prohibition world. And somehow or other, we need to be able to build a post-prohibition world where the fundamental human right of individuals to explore their consciousness is preeminent, and it's beyond just saying, I have a medical need.
Yes, that's
it. It also has to be beyond religious freedom in this sense, because religious freedom requires religion. And that's both a good thing and a bad thing, in the sense that religion is a group process, but spirituality can be individual.
And absolutely, yes.
So I think we need to recognize that MDMA, that we need to build a culture where people have access to tools for personal growth throughout the lifespan, whether or not they have a medical diagnosable condition. But
yes,
right now, as our culture is evolving from the nightmare of prohibition to a more open, integrated sense of drugs and altered state, non-ordinary states of consciousness, that the opening wedge, you could say, the strategic path of least resistance in our culture, we're used to drugs to treat everything, drugs for this, drugs for that, drugs for you know, illnesses that weren't even illnesses. Are you shy? Here's a medicine for you being shy. Here's,
right.
You know. So I think our culture, if we look at actually what's happened with medical marijuana, one of the favorite slides that I use in some of my PowerPoint presentations is a slide of public opinion over the last 40 plus years about the legalization of marijuana, going back to the early 1970s. Okay. And only about 2 years ago did it cross the 50% mark, where more 50% of the voters are now in favor of marijuana legalization.
Hmm.
There was a slight increase from the early 70s up until the late 70s, but it still wasn't great. What happened in the late 70s was the backlash, again, the rise of the parents movement, the Nancy Reagan just say no, the escalation of the drug war, and support stayed pretty flat from around 78, 79, up until around 1996. And what happened in 96 was the medical marijuana initiatives passing in California and in Arizona. And that started spreading to other states. And so the rise of the medical marijuana movement paralleled the rise of the change of people's attitudes towards marijuana legalization.
Right.
And I think what we see there is that people have been given so much misinformation, so much propaganda about the dangers of marijuana, the dangers of psychedelics, and not to say that they don't have their risks, but that people don't know what to believe. But when people can see somebody saying, I used this for medicine and it helped me, and it's somebody that they know. So some of the exit polls have shown that the most important predictor of whether somebody is in favor of the legalization of marijuana, it's not even do they use marijuana themselves.
It's they know
but
someone.
But it's do they know a medical marijuana patient?
Right. You
and
know,
that is a direct source of information that people can trust. And so I think right now the medical use of marijuana has really primed our culture for what looks like a transition well underway towards the legalization of marijuana. And I think the medicalization of psychedelics and the work that's being done with the legal freedoms for ayahuasca, for Native American church use peyote, these are going to be priming our culture over the next 20, 30 years for the eventual legalization of psychedelics.
Which, so when do you see that happening?
Back to your question, you know, people, you know, we're all traumatized. We're all scared of dying. We're all, life is tough and everybody can benefit, but not. Here's the other fundamental thing is that psychedelics are not essential. And I think it's really important to say that, that you can, people can access these states of mind without psychedelics. It's much more difficult. People have to meditate or do any number of things, fasting, or people transcend through pain, like the Sundance that some of the Native Americans do. There's all different techniques that people have. For many of us, and certainly for me, psychedelics have been the most reliable, most useful path. But they're not essential, because psychedelics really – Stan, I think, said it really well. He said LSD is a non-specific amplifier of the unconscious.
Hmm.
And what that means is that when you take LSD, you don't have an LSD experience. You have an experience of your own unconscious.
Right. Yes, that's good. That's real good.
So I think we don't want to say psychedelics are essential. People can get to these states in other ways, and they're it's about where they get to, not the vehicle. And in fact, in the work that's being done with understanding spirituality and the role of psychedelics in mystical experiences, starting in 1962 with the Good Friday experiment, that was one of the best things that Timothy Leary ever did. And I did a 25-year follow-up. It was an attempt to look at 20 divinity students who went into church on Good Friday, and half got a psilocybin mushroom pill and the other half got a placebo. And this was a Harvard PhD. Walter Pankey was a minister and a doctor and working on his PhD. And he spent over a year developing a questionnaire for how you would describe a universal mystical experience. And he based it on the work of a religious scholar named W.T. Stace. And Stace had this theory of causal indifference. And what that meant is that you can describe the state and it's independent of the cause. So somebody could have it worshiping in a Catholic church. Somebody could have it worshiping in a Jewish synagogue. Cool. Somebody could have it hiking in nature. Somebody else could have it having, you know, beautiful sex and feeling, you know, transcending into a unit of mystical experience. Somebody could fast for 20 days or, you know, but it's the theory of causal indifference, which also means that psychedelics are not essential. They're just all parts, different ways to open us up to core human experiences.
Right. Now, core human experiences is one word for it. And a lot of us have a lot of other words for it that scientists aren't going to use. Scientists like you or doctors or people from that side of the universe are going to say that, whereas people like me say, it's God. I'm touching God when I take a psychedelic and I do it in the right way. And the lessons that come to me from that state not only help my life, but my whatever my community happens to be, my relationships get better. Everything gets better from whatever outflow is coming from that core human value place that you're talking about. And I think that it's really interesting to me that if you look at Kurzweil's predictions, 2045, the birth of some new artificial intelligence that is sentient and alive. And I hear you talking about the timeline for psychedelics becoming legal and or prescribed, and I consider the epiphanies that psychedelics tend to produce in people who use them in the right ways. It almost seems like the amplification of technology and the end of the prohibition on psychedelics is somehow intertwined, and that the end result, that they both share a similar end result. Do you know what I'm saying there?
Yeah, I do. And I think there's a lot to that. I think also I want to point out one thing that you said that connects up with the science in a sense, and also the tradition over thousands of years of spirituality, which is that the ultimate test of a religious experience is called the fruits test. So it's not so much how you describe the experience, although that's important, but it's what are the consequences of that experience?
Mm.
And so that's where in scholars of religion and you know, it's like, what is the fruit of the tree?
Right.
And if this experience is really positive and uplifting and produces more love, then that's really what we're looking for and looking at. And again, that focuses on the integration. Now, I do think that many of the people that were involved with the early work with LSD also made a link between particularly Albert Hofmann. You know, in 1938, he developed LSD. They tested it. They didn't see much of interest at Sandoz Pharmaceuticals. And in 1943, he re-synthesized it. He had a peculiar presentiment that there was something there to it.
Right.
And some mysterious way, he accidentally dosed himself. But he made a link between the technological advance of the human species, specifically in terms of the splitting of the atom.
Right.
And the creation of the destructive power of nuclear weaponry, and the opening up of the splitting of the ego through psychedelics,
right.
So that the development of LSD and the development of the destructive power of the atom, or even the creative power of the atom, you could say, it's nuclear power, if we can ever tame that, that there's a parallel, so that we have this incredible development of technology without the spiritual and emotional maturity to deal with it properly.
Right.
And that's where the psych. So Albert Einstein said that our technology has exceeded our humanity.
Hmm.
And he also said that the splitting of the atom has changed everything except our mode of thinking, and hence we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe. What shall be required of mankind is to survive is a whole new mode of thinking. So
wow.
I think this technological advance that Kurzweil and others are talking about needs to be balanced by a emotional and spiritual development that I believe psychedelics can play a major role in creating. And that's where I think it's so important for the human species that we integrate psychedelics and stop suppressing it.
That's right. Because it's not just that – I think that it's not going to just be a balance that comes from more people having access to these psychedelics, though that's a huge and vital aspect of this. But it's also going to be the sort of innovations that are going to come from that place, because it is a place that doesn't just produce healing. It produces novelty. It produces incredible ideas that, you know, a lot of people theorize some of the, you know, whether or not it's true. It's, you know, it's been disproved. We do know that Crick was hanging out with Huxley, you know about that, the DNA helix.
Yeah, oh, for sure. And in fact, Francis Crick never said it when he was alive. A friend of his, after he died, said that there was experiments that were being done with low-dose LSD.
Right.
That Crick was participating in. And it was on a low-dose LSD day that he had the vision of the double helix.
And could be a myth. That could be a rumor. I've seen both sides of it. It might not be real. But we do know that Crick was engaged in some way with psychedelics. And we also know that Steve Jobs was engaged in this way. And we also know that some of the greatest musicians have been engaged in this way, some of the greatest philosophers. So it's not just an outflow of healing coming from this place that opens up, but it's an outflow of innovation. And it makes me think that your work will somehow lead to an acceleration in technological advancements, and not just a balance of the intention for using the technology.
Yeah, and we also know Kary Mullis is one of the best examples. He won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry for developing the polymerase chain reaction, which is used all the time now for DNA analysis, and he attributes his creativity to marijuana and LSD.
There you go. See, that's crazy to think about, that perhaps this prohibition, it's not just keeping people from healing, it's slowed down our progress as a species.
It has. And one of the most things I think that people don't realize is that, you know, over the course of the last multiple decades with the drug war, there's been an enormous pressure from the government on companies to do drug testing, particularly companies that are getting government grants. But if you look at the engines of innovation, Apple Computer, Microsoft, SAP, Oracle, on, these companies do not do drug testing as a requirement of employment.
Wow.
So the Silicon Valley innovation, that's where we see that people don't do drug testing, that
right.
There is this relationship. And in fact, there's a scientist named Jim Fadiman who did work in the 60s with LSD and mescaline with people who had problems, intellectual problems, technical problems that they couldn't solve. And he worked with them with LSD and mescaline to help them come up with new solutions. So I think that these drugs, in fact, are tools of innovation. That's where we get people like Leary and others saying this is always going to be a challenge to the status quo, and these drugs will always be countercultural. They will always be suppressed. It's just in their nature. But I don't think that's true. I think we can value innovation, and we can build a healthy culture that sees those people that are innovators as scouts to the future, not as enemies of the present.
Wow.
But as scouts to the future.
Cool.
And just the same way that we tell people, don't make decisions while you're under the influence of psychedelics, we could say, look, these scouts are going out there. They're having these ideas. But what really matters is, what do they bring back? And then what do we test? And does it really work? And many times it does.
Yeah.
And I think that's really where we look at our culture. The American competitive advantage is creativity, innovation, you know, creating the new. And psychedelics and marijuana are a key part of that. I mean, look at California. That's where you are, Duncan. Look at California is the leading edge in a lot of different ways. And that was the state in 1996 that started medical marijuana. That's where the Grateful Dead, that's where...
Listen, you know, to sum it up for
in addition to Leary and the others here in Boston.
One of my friends, one of my friends, Brody Stevens, has one of my favorite jokes in comedy. And forgive me, Brody, for throwing this out there, but it's so funny. He says, 90% of all comedians smoke marijuana. The other 10% aren't funny. It's such a great gag.
That's really funny.
Yeah, but and it's not, of course, it's not complete. It's just he's just joking. There's sober comics who are hilarious, like Mark Maron. But the point is that these substances are not just the stereotype of the recreational drug user getting blasted and forgetting about the world or whatever. That is not what's going on here. In every single field that comes into contact with these substances, there are innovations that happen that I think wouldn't have happened minus the substance entering into the bloodstream. And that is, to me, one of the great tragedies of the Prohibition is that we don't know what we've missed so far. We don't know what potential luminary could have had that spark of intuition in the midst of some mushroom experience or LSD experience, and what they could have brought back. Because so many of these scouts of the future that you're talking about, they get thrown into dungeons. They're thrown into dungeons for what I would consider to be some of the most important work that humans can do, which is venturing into the subconscious and bringing back whatever we can into this world. It doesn't just heal us psychologically. These psychedelics heal society as a whole. And that healing comes through innovation, if you ask me. Sorry for the rant.
Yeah, no, for sure. And in fact, Kary Mullis, after he won the Nobel Prize, and I had read some of his statements about attributing his creativity to LSD and marijuana, you know, not only, I mean, he had a brilliant mind, but he sent me a quote that was absolutely fantastic. He said, "I think I might have been stupid in some respects if it weren't for my psychedelic experiences."
Wow. That's it.
So this is from a Nobel Prize winner. And so I think that what we need, though, also just to be a little bit more balanced here again, is that these are tools. People can be deluded. People can be harmed. And one of the big problems of our drug war is that we've tried to invest qualities in the drugs themselves. We've got good drugs that are okay. Pharmaceutical companies sell them. We've got bad drugs that are illegal.
Right.
But we've sort of projected outward and given these power to these drugs. And what we've lost is that it's really about the relationship that we develop with these drugs. And that it's the relationship that determines whether it's beneficial, whether it's harmful. You know, the surgeon's knife is the same as the thief's knife or the murderer's knife. It's the same knife. The LSD can cause somebody to become very disoriented and suicidal, or else it can help somebody suicidal in a safe, supportive way.
And that leads me to one last question, Rick, because we only have, I think, about 15 more minutes or 10 more minutes, and it's a very important question. So forgive me if I'm slightly cutting you off a little bit, but not everybody has access to MAPS. Not everybody's going to be able to get into one of your trials. Probably most people aren't. But personally, and I'm sure the people listening, hear you talk about this technique for taking a psychedelic, and I would love for you to give, if you can, some advice for people who want to do this therapeutic work on themselves but don't have access to these types of therapists.
Great question. Thank you, Duncan. So the first thing to say is that because we're doing nonprofit drug development, we are open about everything that we're doing and sharing it. So on the MAPS website, and it's just MAPS, M-A-P-S.org, if you go to the MDMA page, we have what's called the treatment manual. And that's a written description of how the therapy should be conducted. Now, it's tailored for our actual protocols, but there's a lot of information there about the attitude, the approach of the therapists, how they should handle things, how they should be supportive. And so I think if people can look at the treatment manual, and we have what's called adherence criteria, because I said before that we have all of our sessions are videotaped and audiotaped, and we have raters to try to help optimize outcomes, look at the videotapes and then score the therapists on, you know, are they being supportive? Are they being non-directive? Are they encouraging people to look inside rather than to look away? So that people can learn a lot about the therapeutic approach by looking at the treatment manual on our website. The other thing is there's a couple projects that we're doing trying to create a context for a post-prohibition world. So it used to be in the 60s, 70s that the crackdown, the backlash, was about the link between psychedelics and people challenging the status quo.
Right.
You know, I talked about, you know, the Yippies trying to levitate the Pentagon, or the Beatles talking about make love, not war, and, you know, all you need is love and stop against the Vietnam War. But now that has faded, and I think what's really going on is more about parents being scared about their kids. And one of the biggest places is where kids, young kids, you know, teens, 20s, go to these festivals like Burning Man, like Boom Festival.
Right.
There's all these festivals, and then a lot of heavy psychedelic use. And it's part because the rituals that we have, the rites of passage, have been drained of their power, and people are creating them themselves. But we've created what we call the Zendo Project, and that's where we bring trained psychiatrists, therapists, volunteers, social workers to help people who are having a difficult experience. And cool. Try to make that distinction between difficult is not the same as bad. And if you can support people when they have difficult experiences, sometimes in a very short amount of time, you can integrate something and it can transform. So if you go to the MAPS website and look at the Zendo Project, the psychedelic harm reduction, we have a lot of information on how to help people if they're having a difficult psychedelic experience. And it's basically the same as how you would conduct psychedelic psychotherapy. So
cool.
There's a lot of information on the website. And in particular, there's another book called The Secret Chief Revealed. Now, Sasha Shulgin was a brilliant, brilliant chemist who devoted himself to trying to develop all sorts of different psychedelics. He made a big success with Dow Chemical. They gave him his own lab. And in the 60s, he decided to go off on his own. And he and his close associates have developed hundreds of new psychedelics, including he's helped responsible for bringing back MDMA to the world.
Right.
Even though it was invented in 1912 by Merck, it was just forgotten. But then he would find, and this core group of his wife and around 10, 12 other people would take drugs that they found to be particularly useful, and then they would give them to therapists who would be working with them. And the lead therapist was a fellow named Leo Zeff.
Okay.
And he was called the Secret Chief. And he's the one that really trained in the late 70s and on hundreds of psychiatrists and therapists to work with MDMA.
Wow.
And Myron Stolaroff, who also did work with psychedelics and creativity with Jim Fadiman, Myron interviewed Leo, and we published a book, the first book that MAPS ever published, called The Secret Chief. And then years later, when it came to republish it, we were able to identify who Leo was, and it's called now The Secret Chief Revealed.
Cool.
But we have it for free up on the Secret Chief. The book is for free on the MAPS website. And that's pretty succinct description of the different range of psychedelics, from LSD to Ibogaine to Harmaline to Ayahuasca to MDMA and others, and how they were used in therapy, and what Leo's approach was. So I think that is kind of a primer for understanding psychedelic psychotherapy. And I guess I would just say to people who are listening and thinking about it, that it's very important when you approach a psychedelic experience to be open to the full range of things that might come up. Now, it's okay. I believe there's a lot to be said for recreational, celebratory use of psychedelics, yes. group dances, group, you know, Grateful Dead concerts, festivals. Yes. But I think the key thing is that if you are just trying to have a certain slice of experience, I only want to feel love and connection and happiness. When something painful or sorrowful or past trauma comes up, if you're in the mood to suppress it, you're going to end up worse off.
So wow,
I think
yeah.
the attitude needs to be, I'm going to take this. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm going to be open to whatever. I'm going to try to steer this in certain ways. But that if something difficult comes up, I think you really need to be open to it. That's really the core attitude. And also, I really think this idea of the second day to rest, to give yourself time, because psychedelics really are ego dissolvers in many ways, and they are growth and agents of growth. And if you are open to the new, sometimes it takes a while to adjust. And if you give yourself that time, you can have a soft landing. And if you don't, you know, you're going to cause a lot of stress. Now, just to say this, at Burning Man, we're going to have two sites in our villages. One is a tea house, going to be around the 9 o'clock side. The other is going to be around a 2 o'clock side with the Zendo. And so we're trying to demonstrate that if we could move into a situation where harm reduction was accepted as a principle, as a policy, and that we were in a post-prohibition world, that then I believe that we can really have a lot of positive growth of all sorts of kinds, very minimize the risks, although there always will be risks. And I think if people are actually want to get even deeper into it, there's some of the books of Stan Grof. Really, if you can understand the sort of the sweep of the unconscious, meaning that one of the things that emerged from the years and years that Stan Grof and others spent with people under the influence of LSD, I mean, Stan talked about LSD as to the study of the unconscious what the microscope is to biology and the telescope is to astronomy.
Wow.
And so Freud basically looked at what happens during your life, and he said that children are a tabula rasa. You're born a clean slate, and then your environment happens, and you know, but and then most of what's going on with traditional Freudian psychoanalysis is talking about early childhood. But there's the core process of actually being born that imprints us in multiple different ways. And for Stan, that's he's got all sorts of theories about the stages of the birth process.
Amazing.
And, but many people can sort of remember or re-experience the core sort of imprinting from the birth process. And then that's the doorway to the transpersonal. There are all sorts of experiences of spirituality, of going beyond the ego states, of confrontation with death. You know, there's all sorts of transpersonal experiences, so that if you have a model of the unconscious when you approach these things, the sweep of the unconscious, that it's not just about your life. You can be overwhelmed by sadness, let's say, and it's just for the pain of the people that are starving to death right now, or people being tortured, or people in wars. Yeah. It's like it's part of the human collective unconscious. And that's what Jung talked about.
Yes.
So that I think if you can have a broad sense of what is possible, at the same time you can keep a sort of skeptical perspective. So, for example, when a lot of people talk about past life experiences,
yes,
we have found that in therapeutic settings, people can have a past life experience that actually helps them resolve issues in their current life.
Wow. Well, you know, with this stuff coming out with epigenetics, you know, I don't know if these past life experiences could just be contact with some kind of memory genetic that's encoded in us, because it seems like they're finding out that in some way that's being recorded inside of us. The phobias of our ancestors are theoretically being transferred down generations. So maybe that's what it is.
Yeah, yeah. So I think, again, it's like this theory of causal indifference. The idea is that if you can process these experiences, you may be able to feel better, whether you decide later, oh, that was a real past life, that was my actual life, or that was a life I tapped into from the collective unconscious and it's just similar to the issues in my current life, or whether it's epigenetics. I mean, that's where we get back to Richard Rockefeller, where he was very concerned about how do we break these cycles of multi-generational trauma. And I feel like it's appropriate for people to have an open, skeptical mind, but still go with the experience, feel it out to its depth, and see how you can integrate it and how we can all move forward. And over time, with more and more scientific research, looking into spirituality, looking into psychedelics, looking into psychedelic neuroscience, I mean, we're discovering incredible things with new brain scan stuff about LSD and psilocybin and MDMA and how they work. And, you know, but again, how are those things going to translate into refining our therapeutic approach or really helping people get better? And that's where I feel like so grateful for Stan's approach. There's something grounding about, can people find ways to help those who are suffering, and we're all suffering in different ways, get better? And I think that we can, and I think it's a tremendous historical time. So for people who are listening to this, particularly young people, I really want to say that if you have had a thought like maybe you want to become a psychedelic therapist, or maybe you want to become a psychedelic neuroscience researcher, or now, for really the first time in about 50 years, if you want an above ground legal career in psychedelics, anything, psychedelic psychotherapy, neuroscience, you can do it. The wow. world is opening up, and we need people to help us understand the magical richness of the human psyche, which psychedelics can help reveal, and many other things too. So now really for, you know, when I was 18 years old in 1972 and all of this was shut down, I thought, okay, I'm going to devote myself to trying to bring this back. And what I really want to do is become a psychedelic therapist and also go through my own psychedelic psychotherapy. And now more and more it is possible for people to do that. But we have to do it carefully. We want to avoid another backlash. Don't want to get grandiose. We don't want to get ahead of ourselves. But we have a tremendous hopeful opportunity to really bring about creativity, innovation, spirituality. And you look around at the world and, man, we need all those things. But in the end, I'm extremely optimistic and hopeful, more so than I've ever been before.
Wow. You are an amazing human, and we are so lucky to have you with us. And this work that you're doing is so beautiful and selfless. Really, thank God you exist. You're incredible. I hope people listening will check out Maps. We'll go to the Maps website. And if you guys feel like it, you want to, why not send a little green energy their way? Because as you hear, as you listen to Rick, you can see that how necessary this is and how much work you've put in. So much work, Rick. This is a lifetime of work to bring this time period in history into existence. It's amazing.
Well, but even still, you know, I have gotten so much joy and love and learning and hard lessons from my use with psychedelics that it feels like, you know, I'm still trying to pay it back. It's not like I'm completely selflessly. I've gained so much, and I've had so many rich experiences with so many loving people that, you know, I feel like I'm you know, I'm not building up a debt. I'm, you know, sort of trying to pay a debt.
It's beautiful. Well, yeah, that's amazing. It's so cool. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show, Rick. I will have links to I will have links to Maps on the website and the books that we discussed. And really, best of luck to you. And let me know if there's ever anything I could do to help.
Yeah. Well, thanks. And Duncan, when you do put this up, let me know, because we'll try to help promote it as well.
Wonderful. Thank you, Rick. That's it, everybody. Thanks for listening. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, won't you? Go to maps.org. And a big thanks to squarespace.com for supporting this show. Use offer code Duncan. You'll get 10% off a great site. I love you guys. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you next time.
Rose is your name, but when you poop, it sure don't smell like roses. You're number two, burns the hair in my nose. But we fought hand in paw, now your poop don't stink at all. Now that the air is clear, I'll treasure your front and rear, my sweet rose.
Instantly neutralize poop stink with Poop Fighter from World's Best Cat Litter for the world's best cat.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Are you someone who watches every true crime documentary the day that it releases and then find yourself always wanting to know more, Googling the timelines, red flags, and then falling into the social media rabbit hole? Well, I'm here to do all of that for you, bringing the facts, theories, and details that no one else is covering on my hit true crime podcast, Serialistly with Annie Elise. Whether it's everything with the Idaho 4 case now that the documents are unsealed, or shocking cases you've never heard of, packed with love triangles, cults, and twists you won't see coming. With over 1 million downloads a week, I break it down for you just like your best friend would. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.